sweet of you. Could you call our first case, please, Marshall?
Yes. 8190461, Megan Abel, appellant versus Abbott Northwestern Hospital et al. Respondents, St. Mary's University, Minnesota, respondent.
Okay. And counsel, you're all familiar with our practices. Do announce your appearance at the beginning of your argument in chief and adjust the podium if you wish to make it more comfortable for your own argument. Appellant, remind me, did we give you the extra 5 for your argument in chief?
For the rebuttal.
For the rebuttal, okay. So you're going to limit your argument in chief to 15?
15 and then 10 for the rebuttal.
Okay, excellent. And then 10 per respondent is what you will have as well. Okay, please begin.
Good morning, Your Honors, and thank you for giving us the opportunity to present this incredibly important case. It's an honor to be here in general, but of course on such a special day for the court. So thank you for your time this morning. Before I enter into the legal questions presented by this appeal, I want to note 3 important facts.
I'm going to stop you just for a moment. I'm assuming you are Mr. Medell.
I'm sorry. My name is Matt Pelican from Medell Law, and my colleague Ellen Ahrens is here.
Thank you,
as well.
Mr. Pelican.
Thank you, Your Honor. 3 important facts to keep in note as we consider the legal questions presented by this appeal. Number 1, the acts here are egregious. You have a supervisor in a position of power who on the first day of Ms. Abel's practicum made her lie in a street, discussed a colleague's breasts, and when Ms. Abel demurred from his advances, said obeying me is going to be an important part of your experience at Allina and St. Mary's. During her required practicum at St. Mary's and Allina, she was forced to engage in mimicked rape scenes and having amorous allusions to her instructor. The second important fact is that these facts are true, not just true in the procedural sense, but true because Dr. Gottlieb entered into a publicly available consent decree and stipulation post-stating the complaint in this case that the court can take judicial notice of. Dr. Gottlieb has acknowledged the conduct here. This is not a he said, she said. And the third fact is that everyone knew. Allina knew of this misconduct. Ms. Abel began complaining immediately. As we plead in the complaint, by the end of her practicum, she was saying that Dr. Gottlieb was harassing her every day. She told Allina that every day he was violating their own policies. And within the limitations period, they did nothing to fix that. St. Mary's knew, again, from the very beginning, Ms. Abel went to St. Mary's, said this is wrong, it feels inappropriate, and St. Mary's told her it is funny and normal. Within the limitations period, as she confronted these significant issues, St. Mary's told her that it was her fault, that even though, in their own words, her instructor that they sent her to was a racist, it was her fault for choosing it, and she should keep her mouth shut or face significant consequences in her career and her education at St. Mary's.
Counsel, understanding that on appeal from Rule 12, we are bound to accept the allegations as true, and they are egregious, and I don't disagree with any of that. But looking at the complaint, can you point me to any allegations of particular egregious acts that occurred on the one day that is within the limitation period, namely the last day of her participation in the practicum?
Yeah, and to be clear, Your Honor, that's the last day of the limitations period.
Respect to Allina. Yes.
Thank you, Your Honor. Yes, and the egregious act within the limitations period is Allina's ongoing practice of establishing a pattern of discrimination in its practicum, and that occurred in the limitations period. I appreciate Your Honor's question. It turns to the 2 important legal questions here. The first is, are these claims timely? The second is, are individuals like Ms. Abel protected at all under the Human Rights Act? To the first question, which goes to the heart of your question, are the claims timely? In the Minnesota Human Rights Act mandates that you must bring a charge or a complaint within 1 year of the discriminatory practice. And I point the court to language in footnote 11 of Hubbard that I think really resolves the question of the statute of limitations in this case. The Minnesota Supreme Court in Hubbard said that the discriminatory acts of an employer over a period of time indicating a systemic repetition of the same policy constitute a sufficiently integrated pattern, in effect, a single discriminatory act.
So can I ask one clarifying question?
Sure.
Are we in agreement that the statute of limitations runs from May 26, 2016?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
Yes, Your Honor.
I just wanted to make sure that we had the same time frame in mind.
So,
aren't you, I mean, in essence, you're really arguing a continuing violation, are you not?
Absolutely, Your Honor. Yes, this is a continuing violation case that falls squarely within Hubbard and progeny from it, including Sigurdsson and Giuliani. Mm-hmm.
And you know from Sigurdsson that you have to distinguish between acts and effects.
That's right, Your Honor. But again, I point to the language in Hubbard that was adopted by the Sigurdsson court, which is really, you know, the preeminent continuing violation case, you know, that clearly established that doctrine. Hubbard predates it. But this footnote 11 from Hubbard was adopted in Sigurdsson and also quoted in Giuliani, which is a published opinion from this court. And the important thing to keep in mind here is that the discriminatory practice is the act. And this case falls squarely within Hubbard, Sigurdsson, and Giuliani. I point the court to...
So what is the act? I mean, I think the act, I thought the act as alleged is the conduct that you described in your opening statements, the egregious conduct.
The act is the discriminatory practice, and that's verbatim language from Hubbard. And I point to a case like Giuliani or even Sigurdsson.
But the practice is subjecting these practicum students to Dr. Gottlieb's racist, sexist, harassing conduct, isn't
it? Exactly. That's correct, Your Honor.
And did any of that occur on May 26th, the one day that's within the limitation period?
Yes. I mean, Ms. Abel faced, you know, the repercussions of Alina's ongoing practice, which is the discriminatory act under Minnesota law. And I point to a case like Sigurdsson, where there was not a decision made within the limitations period. There was not a, you know, discriminatory act, a grope, a comment. In Sigurdsson, what happened was a failure to correct a discriminatory practice. Under Sigurdsson, that discriminatory practice is the act. And I point again to Giuliani, the same situation. This case is squarely within that. There was no stray comment. There was no grope. There was no, you know, formative decision. This published opinions from this case court and the Minnesota Supreme Court show that a failure to correct a discriminatory practice within the limitations period is the discriminatory act. And that is clear holding squarely within Hubbard, Giuliani, and Sigurdsson. So for purposes of the timeliness of Ms. Abel's claim against Alina, it's failure to make it a safe situation for her. They established a discriminatory, again from Hubbard, a pattern of discriminatory acts sufficient to form a pattern of a single act. And so what they did is they, again, after the last time that they can point to anything they did to purportedly stop Dr. Gottlieb's misconduct, as we allege in the complaint, Ms. Abel was going to every day to Alina saying, this is wrong, he is violating your policy, he is still discriminating against me, and she was forced to remove herself from the practicum early. But because that discriminatory practice extends within the limitations period, under Jensen and the Eighth Circuit, it says only the smallest part needs to extend within the limitations period, and it need not be independently actionable. And I think that's one error of law that we point to from the district court, is this notion that whatever happens in the limitations period has to be independently actionable. And that's just not...
But it has to be actionable.
It
has to be part of the pattern. And that's what I'm still struggling with, is the fact, I think the record is she didn't even appear for her last day of work.
That's correct. She was on the Alina campus, but not at Abbott. But again, I point to the Jensen case from the Eighth Circuit, Your Honor, which is, you know, highly persuasive here, where there the individual did not show up at the work site during the limitations period, and the Eighth Circuit held that that was a continuing violation because of the employer's ongoing failure to remedy the discriminatory practice. And that is the act under Hubbard, Sigurdsson, and Giuliani.
I'm going to take a closer look at footnote 11 and Hubbard, but I'm having difficulty distinguishing between the effect of this prior discrimination versus your argument that this failure to act constitutes the discriminatory act.
Yeah.
Can you just expand on that a bit?
I think that's correct, Your Honor, and I think the case law gets, you know, there's not a bright line here. But, you know, a failure sometimes to promote is a discrete, independently actionable act. And I would point to language, for instance, from Morgan in trying to determine the distinction between these independently actionable events, like a firing, a failure to promote, and a continuing violation. And what Morgan, the U.S. Supreme Court, says is that continuing violations by their very nature involve repeated conduct and can't be said to occur on any particular day. And so the initial act is the establishment of a discriminatory practice. And, you know, in Sigurdsson, it was an ongoing discriminatory employment classification. Sigurdsson relied on a case where it was an ongoing discriminatory testing apparatus. And what these cases say that as so long as there is this discriminatory environment, the maintenance of a discriminatory practice is the event within the limitations period. So for instance, a failure to promote, one, is independently actionable and likely can't be part of a continuing violation. But two, you know, the consequence of that is you have lower pay. You know, and I think under Sigurdsson it's saying that if you merely point to lower pay, that's a consequence. It's not the actual act. But if you are maintaining a discriminatory practice within the limitations period, then you are violating the MHRA within the limitations period. And, you know, I think that there's language in Giuliani on this, which, you know, is that, if I can just find it here for one moment, Your Honor, you know, where the action within the limitations period must be that it is the maintenance of a practice. And again, I point to Giuliani, where there was no decision made, there was no stray comment. It was simply a discriminatory environment that existed into the limitations period.
But I'm looking at Giuliani, and this court said, to establish a continuing violation, a plaintiff must show that at least one incident of harassment occurred within the limitations period.
That's true, Your Honor, and the incident or the act is the practice. And that, if you look at the substance of what Giuliani was deciding, the incident was the continuation of that discriminatory practice. It wasn't a decision made. And I would point the court to Castilla. As Alina identified in their brief, there are different facts in Castilla because the perpetrator there was engaged in the kind of quintessential acts that Your Honors are asking about, the stray comment, the harassing behavior. But his actions weren't at issue in Castilla. Yes, that happened, but the question presented by Castilla is what the employer was doing in the limitations period that was actionable. And so the holding in Castilla is that the employer's failure, not act, but failure to remedy the situation was the incident of discrimination, was the discriminatory act within the limitations period. And as long as they are maintaining that discriminatory employment practice, they are violating the MHRA as to any employee affected by it.
We agree with your analysis on that point. I mean, when would the statute of limitations ever apply in a situation where there is a continuing violation alleged?
Well, I mean, think of it this way. As long as an employer is engaged in a discriminatory employment practice, they are violating the MHRA. And so the statute of limitation runs until that relationship terminates. The last day of employment, the last day of school, or ideally, the employer remedies the discriminatory practice. The employer comes in and actually meaningfully protects its employees.
Well, of course, we did have conduct here by Alina where Dr. Gottlieb was relieved of his supervisory responsibilities initially and then appears moved out of that.
That's true, Your Honor, and I think that's a good moment to take a step back and point out that the vast majority, I think, I don't want to say everyone, but everyone I've read, and the vast majority of these cases are summary judgment cases because they start to get into the question of whether that was sufficient, whether what she was experiencing in the limitations period was, you know, sufficient to constitute a continuing violation. But the holding adopted by the district court here and advocated by the respondents would say that being too scared to go to work, having an employer fail to fix a discriminatory problem is never actionable. Because if it is actionable, then that failure extends within the limitations period. And so the rule, the inverse rule, would be that failure to correct a discriminatory practice, being too scared to go to work or too scared to go to school, is never actionable under the Minnesota Human Rights Act. And I refuse to believe that that's law in Minnesota. I don't think it follows the letter or the spirit of the MHRA. So in terms of the timeliness of the claims, I again urge the court to consider that the maintenance of a discriminatory practice is the act for purposes of the MHRA, and that within the limitations period, both Alina and St. Mary's were allegedly engaged in discriminatory practices in employment and education. The second core question presented by this appeal is whether Ms. Abel or any unpaid intern in Minnesota is protected by the MHRA. We believe that Ms. Abel is protected in the area of employment as to Alina, in the area of education as to St. Mary's and Alina, and in the area of public accommodation as to Alina. And again, we believe that that is squarely within the letter of the law, but I urge the court to again consider the inverse standard, which says that, which was adopted tacitly by the district court and here urged by the respondents, that unpaid interns are wholly unprotected under Minnesota law. And, you know, example we thought as we were preparing for this is judicial externs. You know, it matches very closely. And what you're seeing here is a judicial extern who comes to the court as part of their law school education or undergraduate education. Alina says if a judge is, you know, engaged in the egregious conduct that the court, you know, acknowledges is allegedly, you know, pretty bad here, a judge does that to a judicial extern. Alina says court is absolved. The extern is not an employee. We're not involved in education. We're not a place of accommodation. Too bad, so sad. St. Mary's says the school's absolved. Yes, we sent them there. Yes, we told that student to go work for that judge, even though we knew this history of misconduct. But we can't control that judge. We're not involved here. We have no, you know, they chose to go there. So the rule adopted here, outside of the statute of limitations, would leave the most vulnerable people, people beginning their careers, completely unprotected under Minnesota law. And again, I don't think that comports with the spirit, but even more importantly, it doesn't comport with the letter, which again says a discriminatory practice as to education, employment, or public accommodation is actionable.
Thank you, Mr. Pelican. Your time has expired, but you will have your time for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Counsel for respondent.
Good morning.
Good morning.
May it please the court, counsel, Melissa Rafan and my colleague Jack Sullivan here on behalf of Alina. I'm going to split the 20 minutes evenly with counsel for St. Mary's. As Judge Bjorkman, you and Judge Halbrechts, you have noted, the question is what happened on the last day? And it's critical that something happened on the last day. To say that it is fine to apply the doctrine of continuing violation, which plaintiff seeks to apply as a lifeline because he has run the statute of limitations out under the Minnesota Human Rights Act, flies in the face of black letter law. And if you take a look at the Supreme Court case in Morgan, it says exactly what your honors have said. One act comprising a violation must occur within the limitations period.
And why doesn't the act or inaction, if you will, of Alina in terms of not changing the hostile work environment, why isn't that an act that occurred on the last day of the practicum?
Thank you for the question, Your Honor. That is not an act because you need an affirmative act. It's very clear from the case law, and I think this court's decision in Costilla v. State is exactly the place to look.
And you're talking about a discrete act.
I'm talking about a part of a continuing violation, mm-hmm. Your Honor. So there was no discrete act that occurred on the last day. That's for sure. So the question is whether what occurred or didn't occur in this case on May 27, 2016, the only day that the court need look at, because that's the only nexus between the statute of limitations and the practicum, what happened on that day? And something needs to happen. Inaction does not qualify as an incident that will allow the continuing violation to create a foothold. Costilla v. State, Your Honor. That is a decision of this court, and I think it applies very well to this case. In Costilla, this court held that there were timely acts within the limitations period. And the court looked at the fact that the alleged harasser had made a sexually explicit comment to the plaintiff within the time period and said, look what the harasser did within the time period. The harasser acted within the time period, therefore it means the employer didn't act. But there was an affirmative act. There was action that the employer hadn't corrected in that case. Judge Bjorkman, I think, said it well when she said, when would the statute of limitations ever expire? And the truth is, if you adopted plaintiff's theory that nothing has to happen for the statute of limit for there to be a continuing violation, it would completely eviscerate the statute of limitations. Because a plaintiff could wait for 4 years and then say, now I think I'm going to bring my claim. And the last 4 years, well, the employer didn't act.
Unless the employer did something in that time.
Well, correct.
Stop the practice.
Your Honor, there is no instance here, there's no allegation in the complaint of anything that occurred on that day. And frankly, in this case, Ms. Abel decided 3 weeks earlier on May 2nd that she was going to leave.
Do you agree that the practice, as it's been described, continued on this operative day?
I would respectfully disagree, Your Honor, because there's no...
Point to anything in the record that establishes that the practice had been terminated in some fashion?
Well, I think, Your Honor, it's important to talk about what is the practice. So what are the allegations? What are the allegations of a hostile environment that continue to the last day? And there are absolutely no allegations. The allegations, or as it relates to Dr. Gottlieb making any kind of racially harassing comments, end in December 2015, and there's no allegation of any conduct after that. And as it relates to any sexually harassing comments, there's simply no allegations within the statutory period, which is what Judge Vassily found. So it is the absence of allegations, Your Honor, that indicate nothing happened on that last day, which would give her the foothold to reach back. Now, she relies heavily on the Jensen v. Henderson case, which is an Eighth Circuit case and really is an outlier. And I say it's an outlier because no Minnesota court has ever cited that case for its analysis of the continuing violation doctrine. The Jensen case is also very different, and I pulled the brief of the appellant in that case. And the lens that the court was using in that case to find a continuing violation where there had been no action is different because the court was looking at a 45-day statute of limitations. So Ms. Jensen, unlike Ms. Abel, had 75% less time to bring a claim, and she had been forced from the workplace, taking the allegations as true, by the continuing conduct of the coworkers, and she was on a psychiatric leave, was unable to bring the claim. And what the court said, and I think this is very important for this case, the court said had she quit, it would be a different situation. But in that case, she hadn't quit. She was on a psychiatric leave with the intention of returning to work. And the appellant's brief indicates she had been cleared to return but couldn't go back because of the employer's actions. So what's clear is from the Giuliani case, which says you have to establish one instance of harassment during the statute of limitations. The action, as you pointed out, Judge Halbrooks, does not need to be actionable on its own, but there must be actionable conduct, one instance of actionable conduct within the limitations period to provide that foothold.
As alleged by the appellant, what are the acts that put together made this work environment hostile?
And, Your Honor, candidly, it's hard to understand what they are, because even though she has a 67-page, 285-paragraph complaint, it is devoid of any allegations, any specific allegations, once Dr. Gottlieb is removed from the role. Judge Vassily did note that in early 2016, a couple weeks after after Dr. Gottlieb had been removed from the role, he was in a room with Ms. Abel and he was breathing on her. And Judge Vassily didn't credit that as an act, but even if you credit that as an act, that happened about 5 months before the last day of the practicum. So in this instance,
I'm just looking back at the district court's opinion, but because I know Ms. Abel also talked about, you know, the location of her office and the other practicum student's office and how the proximity to Dr. Gottlieb after 2016 started and he was no longer supervising and the expressions and so forth that she found intimidating. And did the district court comment on that? Was there any credence given to that? And
Your Honor, the district court did not comment on that, but I think it's clear from the allegations, or let me say the absence of allegations in the complaint, that she doesn't allege she was ever in an office alone with him, mm-hmm. other than the one instance that occurred early in 2016.
With the breathing.
There's no allegation after that she ever encountered him in the office. There is no that she encountered him specifically in an office or that she encountered him in the office generally after that one instance. So I think that's the one instance that Judge Vassily focused on. But even that is way before the statute of limitations.
There were some references to her proximity to the doctor. And was that a continuing? Did that change at any time?
Judge Klopaki, they were in the same building. They did not share an office. So when plaintiff's counsel refers to the Jenkins case, it's completely in a posit because they were not sharing an office. They were in the same building. That is true. But the allegations, as the allegations in the complaint make clear, she may have run into him a couple times, but the only specific allegation she has is 5 months before the last day of work.
But she does allege that the part of what made this working environment hostile was the fact that he was still around and that they had to park next to each other. And I know there's no allegation that they ever ran into each other in the parking lot or anything, but if there had been an allegation, this complaint, that he was still working with her on that last day, would that have been enough to save the statute of limitations?
If there had been, so what the court
is... what's missing here? Is any linkage between the prior acts by him and what the situation as it existed on her final day?
What is missing, yes, is exactly that. And I think that the, you know, the continuing violation doctrine is kind of best thought of as a connect the dots. You got to connect the dots if you want to have the continuing violation doctrine apply. And she simply can't connect the dots. And inaction has never been considered by this court enough to have the continuing violation doctrine apply.
Mr. Fan, could you briefly address the employee issue?
Yes, Your Honor. So it's clear that the Minnesota Human Rights Act and Title VII apply the same definition of employee, someone who provides services for the employer. And there's no Minnesota case that specifically talks about who is an employee for purposes of the MHRA, but as Judge Vassily points out, the Minnesota courts borrow from Title VII courts, and the Title VII courts, the federal courts interpreting Title VII, are extremely clear to say that you have to have compensation. That is the threshold issue. That might not be enough, but Graves and its progeny make very clear that you have to have compensation. And the O'Connor v. Day case, which actually had Judge Haney sitting by designation, faced facts very similar to the facts here and found that an unpaid practicum student was not an employee for purposes of Title VII.
If you want to make a summary statement, that would be fine.
Yes, thank you. So for purposes of the court need not reach the issue of whether she was an employee because her claims are time-barred. But if the court were to reach the issue, then she clearly is not an employee for purposes of the Human Rights Act because she was not compensated, and that compensation issue changes the entire face of the relationship. Thank you very much. We ask that you affirm dismissal of the complaint.
Thank you. Counsel for St. Mary's.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Cheryl Hood Langle, and I represent Respondent St. Mary's University. First, I want to congratulate Judge Hallbrooks on her long career on the bench.
Thank you very much.
Just two claims relate to St. Mary's. The educational discrimination claim under the Human Rights Act and common law negligence. The former is both time-barred and fails on the merits because there is no allegedly discriminatory act perpetrated by St. Mary's. And the negligence claim fails because it is preempted by the Human Rights Act. So unlike the case with Alina, there's a different date that triggers the statute of limitations as to St. Mary's. St. Mary's was served with the complaint on March 5th of 2018. Meaning some discriminatory act must have been perpetrated by it since March 5th of 2017. The complaint does not identify any such act, and in fact, at the Rule 12 motion, Abel did not argue that there was any such act by St. Mary's within that time frame. On appeal for the first time, Abel is pointing to one of two emails that a professor sent to her in January of 2018 and tries to suggest that one of those emails can save her claims. She refers to the emails in her brief as negative and aggressive, and she calls the emails hostile in the complaint, but she never calls them discriminatory. She can't because they aren't. Neither email takes or threatens any action against Abel based on her race or gender. The first email simply asks Abel how she's doing. There's a reference to Larry Nassar, and Abel's attorneys somehow think that's a comparison to Gottlieb, but perhaps it makes more sense knowing the email's coming from Abel's mentor to a former junior gymnastics Olympian. The second email...
But also the mentor to whom Abel had made repeated complaints about Dr. Gottlieb and...
Correct.
And was warned before and after her practicum about his conduct. I'm troubled by the suggestion that there's no duty owed if you get past the statute of limitation issue in a situation where you have Dr. Gottlieb being a member of an advisory board at St. Mary's and you certainly have intentional placement of students over a period of years despite numerous complaints without hesitation, it seems.
Well, a couple comments on that. The initial allegation is this recommendation, correct? So, first off, even in the amended complaint, Abel acknowledges that it's not St. Mary's who decides or controls where she goes for her practicum. She has to apply for that, and the site, here Alina, has to accept her for an interview and then offer her the position, and she has to take it. So it was a recommendation, not a decision by St. Mary's. And secondly, the fact that it was a recommendation, that's all the amended complaint says, this is a discrimination case. So importantly, nowhere in the complaint does it say that recommendation was based on Abel's gender or race. Gender or race wasn't even a factor in the recommendation. That has to be alleged because the Human Rights Act protects discriminatory acts based on, because of, gender or race, and that is not there. And then the allegations regarding the supposed indifference or the failure to help her after the fact, that position by Abel relies on case law that deals with schools where the actual alleged discriminatory actor is somebody that they can control. It's a fellow student. It's an employee of the school. And in that situation, when a school learns that something like that is going on and doesn't take steps to protect the students, then they can be in trouble. But that's not the situation we have here. This is a very unique situation because they're wanting St. Mary's to go over to an entirely different entity and tell them how to run their practice and what to do with that person.
Couldn't they simply remove her from the practicum?
They don't have the power to remove her. And if you look at the email sent to her, they did suggest she leave, and the record shows that there were discussions whether she should leave. She chose to stay. St. Mary's can't force her to leave that situation.
But the practicum was part of the curricular requirements of St. Mary's, was it not?
Yes. Those requirements are actually imposed on St. Mary's by the state, so she does have to... take two practicums and an internship, I believe, to get her degree. So all students decide, you know, what types of practicums they want to engage in, what they're...
St. Mary's could not stop the practicum, could not remove her from the program, or could not say, we're not dealing with Alina anymore for practicums? You're saying they were unable to do that?
I think St. Mary's has the power to decide which sites that they are going to send students to. The email makes a reference to if we have to try to examine every doctor and go in and interview them, we're going to have trouble finding any sites. So after the fact, they can choose to do that. None of that is in the record, what has happened after the fact. So all we can deal with is we made this recommendation, and then can you sue a school for indifference over what somebody else does, assuming, of course, that there was this alleged indifference. Indifference doesn't support a cause of action because the school cannot control the actions of a third party. Even under the Human Rights Act, the remedies are not against somebody else. They're against the person who committed the allegedly discriminatory practice. And what makes this case unique is St. Mary's didn't commit the allegedly discriminatory practice. That was someone else.
So if one of your arguments is that any common law negligence or other kind of claim is barred by the Human Rights Act, but if, as you said, St. Mary's is not subject to a Human Rights Act claim under, in this scenario because the student is off campus, then doesn't that defeat your preemption argument?
Well, this is a very unique situation. And again, assuming this had been a St. Mary's actor, she would have fallen under the act. But she doesn't because it isn't. So that does make it unique. The preemption does say if your duty arises under, it's the same duty, you're going to have the same factual allegations, same evidence, it's necessarily preempted. That is the situation because even she acknowledges on page 59 of her brief, she only brought the common law negligence claim as an alternative theory. And she only alleges a breach of a duty against St. Mary's because of this failure or this discrimination and harassing behavior by somebody else. So the evidence is all the same, and it all suggests preemption because that's where she's saying the duty came from, which doesn't make sense. Now, if you look at straightforward negligence, she could have, had she had a duty under the law, try to bring a common law negligence claim that didn't arise. And in the briefing, St. Mary's describes what duties do exist for schools. So there are duties imposed under the law for schools to protect their students from other students and from their own school employees. And there are duties to protect them off-site if it's a school function and the school has agreed to take on a supervisory role. Neither are alleged here. In fact, the opposite is alleged by Abel. She says in her amended complaint that her practicum was at the total exclusive control of Alina, not St. Mary's. The only other duty we see in the law is a duty to protect students from physical harm caused by defects on the property. And again, that does not apply. So none of the duties actually existing in the law apply here for the negligence claim. I also just wanted to point out that the emails, despite not taking or threatening any adverse action against Abel based on her race or gender, were not even hostile, not aggressive, not negative in any way. She never tells Abel, unlike how it's been characterized by her attorneys, to shut up or risk career harm. They don't hold her responsible for Gottlieb's conduct. They don't threaten degree completion on silence. All she says in her complaint is she feared reprisal, but none was allegedly threatened or taken by St. Mary's. So for all of these reasons, St. Mary's respectfully requests that this court affirm the lower court and dismiss the discrimination claims as untimely and on the merits because St. Mary's did not allegedly take a discriminatory act, and dismiss the negligence claim as either preempted or lacking any alleged or recognized duty of care under the law. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Ms. Langel. Rebuttal, Mr. Pelican.
Thank you. To take St. Mary's first, St. Mary's says that the email was not alleged to be discriminatory, but to get a little bit in the weeds of the pleading standard and rebuttal here, discrimination is a legal conclusion. What matters is are facts, sufficient facts alleged, or any facts consistent with the facts alleged, sufficient to sustain the claim. So the magic word discrimination is not controlling. It's whether the course of conduct was itself discriminatory. And as to St. Mary's control over Dr. Gottlieb, the court is correct. Dr. Gottlieb appeared on a pre-screened list of practicum sites. Ms. Abel was not considering going there until St. Mary's recommended Alina in general and Dr. Gottlieb in particular, even at a time that within the allegations, they knew he was, in their own words, a racist. So the notion that St. Mary's had no control over the situation, I believe, is factually false and certainly not consistent with the pleadings. To turn to Alina's argument, I think it's a compelling Law Review article. I love Law Review. I was on it. But it's not reflective of the law in Minnesota, which says, number one, the question is not whether an actionable act occurred within the limitations period. I point to Morgan, the U.S. Supreme Court case, which ultimately found a continuing violation didn't apply. And there, they're very explicit. The continuing violations are often hard to determine. They don't even occur on a particular day. They're so diffuse. It's an ongoing practice. And so it doesn't have to be independently actionable.
But Morgan, I'm looking at Morgan right now, and Morgan makes it very clear. that a charge alleging a hostile work environmental claim is not time-barred so long as, number one, all acts which constitute the claim are part of the same unlawful employment practice, and number two, at least one act falls within the time period.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't say one failure to act. It says one act. And so I get back, we have to have one act, don't we, on her last day of employment?
You are correct, Your Honor. But again, I point to Hubbard, and I know it's a footnote in Hubbard, but that footnote has been applied by both the Minnesota Supreme Court and published opinions of this court, that the practice is the act. And so as we point
I think that's what Morgan says too, that all, but it's got to be the practices that all together becomes the act. And here the practices were Dr. Gottlieb's creepy behavior, weren't they?
And Alina's failure to protect Ms. Abel that created a discriminatory environment. And, you know, it's that failure. And I point to, yeah, there's Castilla, and I agree. The facts in Castilla are distinguishable, but the legal conclusion is not. Because what Castilla turned on, and I'm looking at 593 in Castilla, it says, to resolve whether the state, which was the employer in that case, acted inappropriately within the limitations period, we must consider whether the state's actions were reasonable and the reasonableness of employer's response. And so what Castilla is saying is that if employer's response is unreasonable within the limitations period, meaning failure to fix it, that's actionable under Castilla. And I definitely point back to Giuliani and Sigurdsson, which are not cases of a grope, a stray comment, but the maintenance of a practice. Every day that Alina was violating the MHRA is actionable, and Alina was violating the MHRA as to Ms. Abel within the limitations period by failing to remedy a discriminatory environment at Alina.
What did St. Mary's or Alina have to do to stop the practice and allow the statute to
It's a reasonable person standpoint, Your Honor, and I would again point to the relatively unique procedural posture of this case, because these cases get into the weeds of what was the exact remedy and what happened. And I point the court to Walsh that says not only inferences, the federal standard from the facts, but if any facts could emerge consistent with the allegations in the complaint, the claims must survive. And so we, looking at Castilla, we then, through discovery, would see actual facts, and we could sit here, we'd have depositions, we'd have affidavits, and the court and the parties could say, was that reasonable? Certainly, forcing her to park with Dr. Gottlieb, and as Alina misstated this in its argument, and it misstated in its brief, and you know, it's kind of a don't believe your lying eyes argument, but we allege ongoing practice, and unlike discrimination, I believe ongoing is a factual allegation, not a legal conclusion. And we allege that the conduct as to Abel was ongoing in paragraphs 76, 77, 81, 84, 86. Those are allegations of violations of the MHRA within the limitations period. We say it was ongoing. We say it continued. You know, we say ongoing 13 times. And we allege that she went to her supervisor every single day saying, he's breaking your policy, he's harassing me, he's staring at me, I don't feel safe, please fix it. This is a woman who was going to her beginning her career, saying, please help me. And Alina said, she's having a great practicum. I mean, that's in the complaint. At the same time, she's going saying, please help me, I don't feel safe. Her supervisor said, she's having a great practicum. You know, that indicates that Alina was not interested in helping her, was not interested in protecting her.
Wasn't that based on her performance as opposed to, you know, her oral experience?
You know, I we're in a slightly odd posture. I've read all these emails. They're not part of the record now. I don't believe that's consistent with what discovery would show. But again, given Walsh and its progeny and the pleading standard in this case, if any facts show that, you know, she was feeling unsafe and that wasn't tethered, then the claim survives. And we can come back here and have a conversation once we have depositions and, you know, all of that. But I believe that it's alleged to be ongoing within the limitations period.
St. Mary says that there's nothing they could have done to stop this, quote, practice.
Well, I respectfully disagree, beginning with taking Gottlieb off your advisory board when you say he's a racist.
Which they did.
After it became public, not after they had actual private knowledge of his misconduct. Neither of these entities did anything until there was a PR risk. And, you know, that's just part of the impunity here, where you have a young student who has been totally traumatized by her experience and had doors at Alina slammed in her face every single time she came. Again, not in the complaint, not part of the record. I've read these emails, and you know, there's a conversation where she went and said, please help me, and they shut her down, asked yes or no questions, I believe that is in the complaint, and didn't allow her to even say what she was doing. She was so frustrated. This is a college student or a doctoral student, went above and beyond, sent an email saying, I felt like that conversation, you didn't listen to me, and this is a crisis, help me. And there are these emails, and they're saying, oh, well, that's not reflective of my understanding of the conversation, and, you know, this isn't, you know, that's not my recollection. And it's like, I mean, what does it take?
What specific parts of this practice were ongoing on the last day?
Forcing her to see him every day, not disciplining him for staring at her, breathing on her. She told her supervisor about that, and I've seen the emails. I see no record of corrective action on that. But again, we're at Walsh. Any facts consistent. They didn't fix it. He went into her office. He breathed on her. He glared at her. She did have to ride the elevator with him.
None of that happened on the last day, the only day that is within the one-year statute of limitations.
Because she was so scared of facing Alina's ongoing discriminatory practice that she hid. And if the court affirms the district court, if the court adopts what the respondents are saying, the law in Minnesota will be hiding at home is not actionable. You have to report in person to be harassed. And again, that's not the black letter law in the state, and it's certainly not in the spirit. I point at Walsh, any facts consistent sustain this claim, and I point at the MHRA, that the purpose of the MHRA is to be construed broadly to eradicate discrimination. And here we're listening to a very fine technical legal argument that doesn't comport with the published opinions of this court, but also is so far divorced from the reality of the purpose of this law and the letter of this law, that she is designed to be protected, and if the district court is affirmed, not only Ms. Abel will fall between the cracks, but every unpaid intern, potentially in Minnesota, has no protection under the MHRA, and if you're too scared to go to school, too bad, you can't sue under it, because the opinion of the district court says that's not a discriminatory act. So if you're hiding at home, you don't go to school, the school has no obligation to fix it. If your boss is saying mean things to you and harassing you and you are too scared, even though you've confronted your boss's boss repeatedly and said, help me, and they don't do anything, so you are too scared to go to work, the holding advocated by Alina would be that is not actionable, and that if you are too scared to go to work, you can't sue under the MHRA, because if you could, then Ms. Abel's fear of going to Alina on her last day would be a discriminatory practice and would be actionable, and I say that it is. So, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Pelican. Thank you to all counsel. The matter was well briefed, well argued, and the court appreciates that very much. The case has been submitted.